So I gave a, since we have some field theorists in the audience, I gave a fancy title. But I think the interest in the title and will come clear within a couple of slides when I start talking about the methods that we've developed. So I came into the problem of electrostatics and electrodynamics and fluctuation-based potentials by a very roundabout route. About 5 years ago, I was in Mainz, and Mainz has a very distinguished polymer theory group that's based on a lot of numerical methods. They have a major numerical effort in the institute. And I was sitting in for a day of presentations where people were talking about the dirty internal details of the codes that they use to simulate polyelectrolytes. And the way these codes work is that you have to, if you've got a charged polymer, you have to calculate the Coulomb interaction between all the charged parts of all the polymers. And of course, it's very inefficient to sum this pairwise because you have lots of pairs of interactions. If you have n particles, you have order n squared pairs. So what you do is you take your charge distribution, you interpolate that charge to a lattice, and then you solve the Poisson equation on the lattice. And every time step, you have to solve the Poisson equation. And that seemed to me a most inefficient and unhappy way of doing things. You've got this perfect solution, and you move your particles epsilon, and you have to resolve everything from zero. And so we went away and were looking for methods that could reuse the information that you've built up about the system in terms of the electrostatic interactions. These methods are universally used. For instance, if you go into the, if you have some biologist that comes and he puts up a simulation of a protein and he's simulated his protein for 1 nanosecond on some enormous computer, he will have done exactly the same thing. For instance, the AMBER program, which is widely used for simulating biological molecules, has an electrostatic solver, which comes from NIH. I think Tom Darden is the major motor in the writing of that. And that works exactly the same way. You have the lattice, you interpolate charges from the continuum to the lattice, you solve the Poisson equation. So after having thought a bit about how to do this better and more simply, we spent a lot of time thinking about the thermodynamics of electric fields and how to write down the partition function of charge systems, not so much the field degrees of freedom, but how to think about the electrostatic or the electric degrees of freedom. And then when we pushed this a little bit further, we suddenly started coming to partition functions that we found a little strange. And we started getting the idea that this was something to do with fluctuations in dielectrics. And in fact, that our methods were automatically summing in the classical fluctuations in dielectrics. And so we were getting for free something more than just the solution to the Poisson equation in the presence of a dielectric. That motivated us to push much harder on the numerics, specifically for studying the interactions between dielectrics. And that will be the major part of what I'll talk about today. And then I'll show how you can push the methods that we developed here in the classical limit to go on to study the quantum limit, both in non-retarded and retarded systems. So, having said that I don't like solving the Poisson equation, let me tell you the mechanics, a little toy model, an automata, and then I will show you that this has something to do with electrostatics. And that will take 2 or 3 transparencies. So let me take a lattice, and of course I've already told you that everyone uses a lattice anyway. Everyone, all your biologist colleagues will have a lattice in the background for solving the Poisson equation. So let me take that as given. I will take a lattice, and I'll look at 2 sites. On the first site, I'll put a charge, Q, and for the moment I'll have the second site empty. I'm going to introduce a strange rule. Whenever I move a particle with a charge, I will take the value of the field E, which is associated with each link of this lattice, and I will do a slaved update. I will take the field here, the field E12, I will displace the particle, I will update this field E12 goes to E12 minus Q. And then in my algorithm, I'm going to do a Monte Carlo algorithm. I will say, well, my energy is just going to be a sum of E squareds over all the links. And I will put that into a Metropolis type rule. My claim will be that this is entirely equivalent to solving the Poisson equation, and that you move one particle, one lattice spacing, and you have just one link to update. So you, the contrary to the Poisson equation, you don't have the sum interactions over long distances. Now this looks very strange, but let me put a little bit more information on the figure. I'm going to tell you now that everything is going to be based on Gauss's law. And Gauss's law tells me that if I have a charge, I have an electric flux. So this charge here, I will take the charge Q equals 1, then I can solve Gauss's law that the flux surrounding this particle is 1 by choosing, for instance, in a rather arbitrary fashion, that the flux on each outgoing link here is 1/4. My update rule was I displace the particle and I move, I just replace this field here by the field minus the displaced charge, so it becomes a minus 3/4. And I can see here that if I choose 1/4 on these links here, I had 1/4 coming into this site and I chose 1/12 going out on these three sites, I have a net flux here of 0. I do this one update. Now my net flux here is 0. My net flux here is 1. I've imposed Gauss's law as a dynamic constraint. I've produced a conservation law in this system by choosing some strange dynamics. Okay, so that's the constrained electrodynamic part of the title. I'm choosing only some subspace of electric fields as being possible. Now, why might that have something to do with electrostatics? Let me go to a continuum notation. I've got an energy which is E squared, integrated over space, and I've just told you that I'm going to use a dynamics which has some conservation law on Gauss's law. And so I can write a constrained minimization problem. If I were working at zero temperature and I was minimizing everything, I would write a constrained minimization. I'd minimize E squared, give it with div E equal to rho. And I take the variational equations from this. So I take the variation with respect to E, and I find that E, and I integrate by parts, is just minus grad phi. And then I add the constraint back in again, and I find that phi, the Lagrange multiplier for the constraints, is so phi obeys the Poisson equation. So indeed, I find the equations of electrostatics at least as a minimization problem. But as I told you, I'm not interested in doing minimization, because if I minimized everything, I'd move a particle, and I'd have to minimize globally my system. What I'm actually doing is sampling a partition function. I have I have my particles which move around. When the particles move, the electric field fluctuates. I have some statistical weight, which is just the electric energy of the electric field. And then the thing that makes this all interesting is that I have a delta function, which is just Gauss's law again. This is because my dynamics have a conservation law, and I only remain on the subspace of field configurations compatible with Gauss's law. Now, there are two places where you might have seen this sort of approach before. In condensed matter physics, there's lattice-Boltzmann hydrodynamics. You try to simplify the Navier-Stokes equations, and rather than doing that with particles, you introduce some lattice dynamics. And essentially, if you produce any dynamics which have the local conservation law of momentum, then on large scale, you generate Navier-Stokes, and you generate, for instance, Osine tensor, which goes as 1 over R. The other place where you might see this, if you come from the field theory side, is that this is some way similar to the way that Dirac, for instance, presents quantization in his book on quantum mechanics. The idea is that you have equalities in the universe. You have some set of equations for the dynamics, but then the universe has some initial condition and the initial condition is that Gauss's law is valid. And this is exactly what I do here. I start off with one condition chosen by hook or by crook, compatible with Gauss's law, then forever my dynamics will remain compatible with Gauss's law.
One question here, Tom.
Yeah?
Why do you have to use E as a separate field, and then phi also enters via the data function?
Okay, I never use phi in the numerics, okay?
Because I know the...
What you're tempted to do is to write grad phi squared upon 2.
Yes, exactly.
Minus rho phi.
Yes.
This is catastrophic because the sign is wrong. This is not the Coulomb energy. It's minus the Coulomb energy.
Okay, let's multiply it by minus.
But then in numerics, it's no good, you see. If you're trying to do numerics, you've got a saddle point. You're minimizing over fields but maximizing over particles. So you've got a saddle point rather than a minimum. And so if you're trying to do Monte Carlo, your computer will fall off the saddle point and your code will explode very rapidly.
I mean, you've been to mines and you listen to these people. This is how you start with polyelectrolytes. That's the electrostatic energy.
Yeah.
Rho is just psi squared for the polyelectrolyte field and so on. But that's essentially what you start with.
But if you try to do a Monte Carlo algorithm based on this, you get gravitation, you see. If you want to have something which is globally convex, essentially the sign is wrong. The sign of the interaction is wrong with this.
You have it with the mind.
And it's because you've got a scalar field here and you've got a vector field there. And so there's a little theorem that comes from field theory that if you've got, for instance, a scalar or a L equals 2 field, then you get attraction, and if you've got a L equals 1 or L equals 3 field, then you get repulsion between the same objects. So you need to work with the vector. But you'll see the link in a moment between the more conventional way of doing things. So that was our trick for producing a Monte Carlo algorithm, which is purely local, and which generates electrostatic interactions without you ever having to sum 1 over R or without you ever having to solve globally the Poisson equation. The obvious thing to do is then to ask, well, can you do this with dielectrics as well? Technically, the problem is more difficult for the atomic simulators because if they have a dielectric present, then you can't solve the Poisson equation by just using Fourier transforms. And so we asked ourselves, well, what happens if you add dielectrics to our trick? Well, clearly, you go to any undergraduate textbook, and they will tell you that in the presence of dielectrics, you should introduce a field D, and div D is equal to rho, and that the energy is D squared over epsilon. Now, indeed, you take these equations, and you minimize using the constraint again, and you find... a similar generalized Poisson equation, which is the correct Poisson equation. But the interesting thing for today is what happens if you get rid of all external sources of charge, put rho equal to zero, then you get some partition function. This partition function is a constraint on div D. And you've got some non-trivial weight, which depends on the position of the particles. If you've got some set of you've got some epsilon of R, then this is a non-trivial partition function which corresponds to electrodynamic fluctuations in the presence of some dielectric. And the question is, what does that correspond to? And I hope I'll convince you that it is the classical version of the fluctuation potential in presence of dielectrics. So just to remind you, you have a pair, you have a dielectric becomes, because you've got some set of dipoles hidden in your material, and there's old results going back to the 20s due to Keesom and Debye, that for instance there is a fluctuation potential at finite temperatures between a set of dipoles, which goes down like 1 over r to the sixth. And indeed, if you go to the more sophisticated Lifshitz picture, there's an omega equals zero contribution in the Lifshitz theory. And so we took our Monte Carlo algorithm with D and said, this is fantastic. We're going to have a tool that will enable us to measure these interactions in very complicated geometries. And we, the first thing we tried to do was measure the interaction between two plates. And we got the following rather disappointing result, that we measured the interaction between two plates in quite a small system, and we put in a lot of numerical effort, and this is the result of the Lifshitz theory, and our interaction energy that we measured by thermodynamic integration was sort of compatible with that result. But we realized there was so much noise in the curves that this was not the way that we were going to be able to look in a more detailed manner. So we're very happy that you do a Monte Carlo algorithm with this algorithm, and you've got these zero-frequency Lifshitz interactions resummed exactly in arbitrary geometries. But measuring free energies in a simulation is always difficult. You measure energies easily, but free energies, you always have to use some sort of thermodynamic integration. In the end, it's horribly, horribly inefficient if you want to use that as a tool.
Why not going?
Okay, so that was where we started. And now I'm going to move on to the second part of the talk, which is how we developed other methods that enable you to measure that more precisely. I come from a community which is fairly interested in soft condensed matter and biophysics, and where you do a lot of modeling. So just to remind you that most atomistic codes, you look at AMBER, which is used by all the biologists as one of their reference codes for measuring interactions. They put in essentially Leonard Jones and Coulomb and a few other little local interactions, but all collective multi-body interactions in the sort that everyone is aware of today are completely neglected. And for instance, you look at these zero frequency terms in the Lifshitz energy, and they should shield due to the presence of ions, and so you would expect that parts of your Leonard Jones should shield exponentially with half the Debye length, and there's none of that in any semi-microscopic code. And even if you go to quantum chemistry, where you solve Schrodinger-like equations or you'll do density functional theory, unless you use very, very sophisticated functionals, then you neglect, again, all long-range parts of the interaction. So most people who do numerical modeling neglect all these things completely. But we decided to go away and try to find methods that can go beyond the simple special geometries where you can calculate these Lifshitz energies, these fluctuation energies exactly. So, for instance, in high symmetry situations, you can often solve things exactly. I showed you that we had this Monte Carlo algorithm that very nicely includes things exactly, but for extracting detailed numerics, it's not very good. Of course, essentially any computer simulation, as I say, that is done by most people in the biophysics or soft condensed matter physics community neglects entirely any idea of multi-body interactions. And we wanted to produce work that would enable us to go to difficult geometries, so where you might have points, rough surfaces, places where perturbation theory might be impossible to use. And I have to say that I'm a little unhappy that I missed Stephen Johnson, who was here. And I think much of what I'm going to say parallels work that he presented, though the specifics of the methods that we use are rather different.
So this is all zero frequency, classical Lifshitz?
At the moment, I'm at zero frequency. The last part of the talk will be how to get away from zero frequency. So let me go back to my energy again, my free energy, expressed in terms of D. Then I said that the potential is essentially the Lagrange multiplier, and now I'm going to do integration. If I write this I can replace the delta function by an integral over I phi, Now I'm in a position to do the integral over D. If I do that, then I'll come to some sort of partition function, which is perhaps more familiar with people working in this community. It's now a partition function which is expressed as an integral over the Lagrange multiplier. And but I think it's really nice to present the version in terms of the electric field, because the physical degree of freedom is the electric field, and in terms of counting polarization states and so on, it's much clearer what you're doing when you work in terms of E, even if you then transform the partition function into something that involves phi. So you can do this integral analytically and formally is some determinant. In the end, you can convert all these Gaussian integrals into some determinant, and the question is, how do you evaluate the determinant numerically? Well, the first thing to do is to discretize and turn it into a determinant of a real matrix. So what we do is take our grid from the very beginning, and now the potential phi is defined on each grid point, and for instance, derivatives of phi are just differences between phi on neighboring grid sites. Then we tried a series of methods. Firstly, we just chose the most stupid eigenvalue solver that we found we could find. Then we looked into other methods like iterative methods. Neither of these were particularly useful. Beyond that, we went into a method of factorization and reordering with factorization, and I'll show you in a moment what they do. So why are direct methods bad? Let me take a problem in 3D. So a volume which has L to the 3 sites in it, and then it's well known that if you want to diagonalize a matrix, then you need to actually do V cubed operations. The standard implementation of most diagonalization codes is cubic in the size of the matrix. So I have a numerical effort which is diverging with the strong power of the size of the system, and a few little tries shows you that you can't go beyond system size beyond about 20 before you hit a wall, both in terms of CPU time and in terms of pure memory needed to stock this dense matrix. You start out with a matrix which is sparse. You've got a derivative operator, so most of the elements are zero, and only a few of the elements of a Laplacian are non-zero when you do a finite difference. If you try to do these dense operations, you end up with dense matrices where you fill up the whole matrix, and so you have L to the 6 elements to calculate to do this sort of approach. I'm still very interested by the Lanczos method, which is widely used in, for instance, 1D systems. And it gives fantastic fantastic results if you're only interested in the low-lying spectrum. If you've got a problem where all the physics is purely dominated by just a few modes, then I think that this could be a good candidate. It's an iterative method. But at least for the version I showed you a moment ago, you need the determinant of a big matrix. You need all the eigenvalues, and this is quite bad in the Lanczos method. So what did we do? We discovered the Chlesky method. So Mr. Chlesky was a French mathematician in the late 19th, early 20th century, and he was actually the head of map making for the French army. And to make a map, you do a triangulation between two villages, which are separated by a few kilometers, and then you want to do a detailed map of all of France and know the distance between Paris and Nice. And what you have is an overcomplete set of equations, and you need to do some least squared fit to those equations. And you're doing this in the late 19th century. And so he invented a clever factorization, which turned out to be still very useful and still very widely used. So let me take a symmetric positive definite matrix M, and I'm going to take as an example a Laplacian operator, And this is the Laplacian operator in three dimensions. And I've plotted in blue the elements of the matrix which are non-zero. So you see, as I said earlier, this matrix is almost entirely zero. And there is just two lines here. And then there's actually another set of very fine lines. This is the three-dimensional version, which are too fine to resolve on the screen. What's remarkable is that if I calculate, so I factorize this matrix into a product of two matrices, the matrix and its transverse, and I impose that A is a triangular matrix. What do I mean by a triangular matrix? I mean that strictly the lower part of this matrix here is zero by pre-existing decision. And what's remarkable is that if I take this factorization, the elements which are non-zero in this matrix are bounded by the bandwidth of the original matrix. So I see that most of the time, if I go out from the diagonal and I hit here, then I fill in completely out to there. But I see there's a little bit of the matrix here. I should rather go up. Here, where I don't hit this outer line, and so I've got a little blip in the figure showing that I'm strictly bounded by the bandwidth of the original matrix. This matrix still has a lot of zero elements and is a more efficient candidate for factorizing matrices. We want to take a determinant of a triangular matrix is simply the product of all the diagonal elements.
Bandwidth scales with L?
Bandwidth is here L squared. So this in 3D. But this is not the best thing you can do. So there's George and in 73 pointed out that you could reorder the numbering of a matrix in such a way to improve even more the scaling of the Cholesky factorization. And so what he does is the following. Let me illustrate it in two dimensions. Let me take a two-dimensional lattice, and I chop it in two. And then each bit left over, I hierarchically chop up. And then I start numbering, and I number my sites in the following way. I number these lowest level sites first, then I number sites on the shorter cuts, and at the very last moment I number the sites on the largest scale cut in the system. Now imagine you're doing field theory or statistical mechanics and you're tracing out degrees of freedom. You see, if I trace out this, then it can only introduce effective interactions in some nearest neighborhood of this point, and I can't introduce effective interactions beyond a cut. So I can eliminate essentially all these lowest level sites without producing a dense set of interactions between the remaining degrees of freedom.
I'm just getting a little too much. What's the logic for connecting the dots and then counting?
So I take my site, I take a lattice.
Tell your friend and he'd get the same answer.
Yeah. I take a lattice, I cut it in two. Okay. Then I've got two pieces, and then I do that hierarchically. Each piece I keep on cutting in two.
So your friend would get the same answer.
Yeah. And then I start numbering from the shortest cuts. So the shortest cuts are just the individual sites left over. Then I number on the short cuts. Then I number on the longish cuts. So I order the pieces of network that have been left over in this process and number by the length of the cut on which they live.
This is obvious to everybody. I apologize. You tell your friend, look, cut it in half vertically. and mm-hmm. see what you can do horizontally, and then give yourself a rule of working this way, this way. There must be some.
Then afterwards there are ambiguities, but right. You know, if you number this one before that one, it doesn't actually change anything.
Okay, so
there are, you can scramble to some degree the order that you number. You don't have to do exactly those in a certain order.
But it's going to be important whether single dots are near three connected things and five connected things, right?
So the point is,
does that change?
No, imagine you start eliminating degrees of freedom. You sum over this degree of freedom, then you can't generate an interaction between here and there. You can only generate an interaction, for instance, here to there and here to there. And so what happens, let me explain why it's useful. You do this, and this is my Laplacian operator. So my Laplacian operator has looks now completely scrambled and has some sort of fractal hierarchical nature. And then I calculate my Shalesky factorization. And this is a bit difficult to see, but I can assure you that the number of sites here that are blue is considerably smaller than the number of sites that was blue in the Shalesky factorization on the previous slide. And essentially what happens is it enables you to eliminate almost all the sites, and then you get this last separator which remains, and then on this last separator all the sites are connected. So what happens is you integrate out all the degrees of freedom and you end up with one big separator, and your numerical evaluation is dominated by the solution for this one separator. And essentially you then have something which has to be very close to some sort of surface green function. This hierarchically generates a surface green function on this separator. Okay, so that's the most technical part of the talk. If you do this, it enables us to go to something like a system size of 120, and it takes about 15 minutes for us to do one factorization and one determinant. Okay?
So what's the scaling of the decomposition?
So the amount of memory that's needed increases at L to the fourth, and the time that's needed for this decomposition is L to the sixth.
But before we just needed L to the ninth.
Before it was L to the nine, okay? So you win L3, and when L is 100, it's a lot. So the typical sort of thing you can do with this is to discretize a system with some degree of detail. This is a discretization of an 80-cube system, so it's fully three-dimensional, and we just tried looking at the interaction between some point and an indentation in a surface, and we compare with the proximity force approximation, and this geometry is, of course, chosen to be particularly unfavorable because you would calculate interactions vertically like this, but, of course, in this sort of point geometry, interactions are dominating in this direction, so you've got an edge, a corner, which is very sharp, and you're dominated by some diagonal distance as being the minimum. And then you can plot the interaction energy as a function of, for instance, dielectric contrast. How do you know you've done something which is physics and not pure artifact? You just scale this, and you do it for several different system sizes. And if you have some reasonable physics coming out, then your points for different system size should closely follow each other or superpose. I don't have that on this figure, but I have a slide in a minute or two where I'll show that. So this sort of shows you the degree of detail you can have. This was, as I said, fully three-dimensional. We happen to use a system with a circular geometry, but we don't use the circular geometry at all in the solution, and so one could imagine essentially arbitrary geometries with this degree of discretization and measure interactions in a time which is reasonable. This curve is a morning run on our workstation. So that's how to get the classical bit, but what would you need to do to get the quantum interactions as well? And as we've discussed a little bit, I quite like working from interactions with matter rather than working purely in terms of fields. So what you need to do is to say, well, my microscopic material has some microscopic dipolar moment, and I have to associate a kinetic energy with that dipole moment when it's quantized. And to this local kinetic energy, I have to associate the electrostatic energy due to the long-range interactions. So before I was writing everything in terms of d's and epsilons. How do you write this? So what is the generalization, or what is the equivalent formulation in terms of d and p? It turns out to be this energy function. I have two contributions. I have a term d minus p squared upon 2. And this is, of course, if you remember undergraduate electrodynamics, this is just e squared, but written in terms of the physical degree of freedom p. And then you add another term, which is just quadratic in p. And it turns out that the coefficient that you should use in this energy is 1 over the electric susceptibility. So a few lines of trivial algebra where I do, again, this constraint minimization using div d as a constraint shows that this is indeed exactly equivalent to what I wrote earlier on. You take this sort of energy, do the algebra again, and essentially what you find is a very pleasant result that the free energy, or the partition function for the whole system, quantum, is just a product of the Matsubara frequencies of exactly the same partition function that I just showed you how to evaluate in the classical limit. Okay, so I showed you I can calculate the determinant of a large matrix. If I want to do the quantum problem, it's harder because I have to do lots of matrices, lots of determinants, but the machine, the code that I'm going to use is essentially identical, and I just put it in a loop. Now, how many of these things you have to do depends on exactly how you evaluate your free energies. If you really want to take reasonable physical systems, and you take, for instance, a reasonable dielectric constant of 5, and you choose that your quantum system has a frequency h bar omega 0 over kt, which is about 10, then you need to take about 50 Matsubara frequencies. If you're interested in the zero temperature limit, which is often the case, because the thermal fluctuations are a small limit, you can get by with about 15 of these determinants. Okay, so I said you can do one of these determinants in 15 minutes in the classical limit. You need a few hours to calculate the free energy of the system in the non-retarded quantum limit. How do you go on to...
Yeah? Factorization, I'm a bit confused. So you say you just replace epsilon by epsilon?
It's essentially like when you write the free energy, you know, you write that it's an integral over omega, but some log of...
Before you looked at the Poisson equation, right?
So yeah.
Now you should basically solve Helmholtz equations, so you have an extra dependence on frequency. It's not just that you...
No, this is the non-retarded case. How do you do the how do you go to the retarded case?
Okay.
Then you just go to Landau and Lipschitz, and you write. Then you have to calculate this sort of determinant.
Okay.
But we see that it's very similar. We have some spatial structure derivatives, curl of curl. It's a little more complicated than the Laplacian, but it's some local operator with something like, you know, some reasonable number of local interaction terms. You put the dielectric properties here, and then what you're interested in is determinants of this thing. Now, this is a bigger matrix than the one I wrote down earlier. Earlier, my matrix came from some scalar fluctuation. And so if I did the discretization of n, or of L cubed, then I had L cubed as my dimension of my matrix. Since I've got now a vector field, which is fluctuating, Then I have a matrix which is 3V by 3V. And this term comes, of course, just from the wave equation in the temporal gauge, for instance, that you can write like that. So again, you have to do the similar sort of thing. You've got the wave equation. You turn that into some discrete set of derivatives, which is a matrix. This matrix has a dimension of something like a million by a million. And then you just have to calculate the determinant. What we've tried to do is explore some geometries which were particularly difficult, or which we thought were testing. What we were interested in is, you know, are the discretization errors completely unacceptable? Do you just get noise when you do this? How big a system can we do before our computer gives up? What we've done is used very, very simple spectra. So most of the curves I will show you just have one-pole approximations for the spectra, but this is not at all limiting. If you put in a more complicated spectral function, the Gaussian integration scheme will work just as well. And essentially with equivalent efficiency, you can put in a much, much more sophisticated spectral function, and that's not at all the limiting part of the code. And all what we were interested in doing was producing something which was reasonably lightweight and easy to work with. So all our simulations tend to be in units of one del weeks. So I don't think any curves will take longer than that to produce. So this is one geometry that we played with. Was the interaction between two disks. I already showed you a fairly fine discretization of something where we were taking a point and pulling it out of a hole. That's a particularly easy thing to do because the self-energy of the system doesn't change when you're just displacing uniformly something with respect to a background. If you've got a disk, it's a little harder because you can line up so that you've got a disk with two different dielectric properties on it. And of course, when you're at zero or 90 degrees, the line separating the two dielectric properties line up exactly with the network. But if you're at some inclined angle, then you have some roughness necessarily imposed by the lattice. And we were worried that this fluctuation in self-energies of the individual disks would be much too big and would drown out any signal of interaction between two disks. But we did the tests, and we chose a system. I think here we choose a box size 63, and the disk is size 42 in terms of the lattice spacing. And that was the point. Those are the black points. We look at the free energy as a function of angle. And then we use a different system size, and those are the red points. And we see, essentially, that already with this degree of discretization, the results are coherent to within 1 or 2%. And so we were quite happy that we seemed to be able to get over this problem of roughness in the interface, which gives big fluctuations in the self-energy in the disks.
Can you estimate the magnitude of the torque?
Oh, we could, yeah. We can do this trivially, yes.
Can
because
you give us some number?
Not. I don't have the number with us because we plotted it.
There was an experimental talk a few weeks ago, and I think it was Umar Mohideen, and
yeah.
He put up some number for the what kind of torque would be needed to go, to be bigger than the accuracy of what they can.
Yeah, the machinery automatically did this, but we've plotted for the moment in terms of.
I understand.
Because we were interested in, above all, in the controlling the errors, and so we were scaling things in such a way that we can compare two different systems.
So
different.
Better or worse, I guess there are how close and how far things are. So the green line is as though they're really, really, really close.
No, the green line would be if they were almost touching, and then you would get a triangular potential.
And how does this blurriness come in? It has to come in as you decide how far apart to hold them and how grainy to make the objects, right? And that's basically what we're seeing here.
In fact, our original curves had the thing closer together.
Yeah.
But then when we decided to do the comparison, we had a set of distances which were not commensurate. So we wanted to scale everything. So essentially, we wanted to scale the diameter, the thickness, and the separation by some lambda, which was identical for everything. And so we ended up choosing a distance here, which was larger than we were otherwise plotting. We have another system which is much closer together, where indeed you see the rounding off much.
You chose one for those dots, and I didn't get clear. How far apart are they compared to the blue stuff?
The separation is equal to their thickness.
That's the one we happen to have here.
Which was convenient for scaling.
This thing's not scaling as to the fourth or something in thickness. Thickness is not coming in some trivial way here. It just happens. If there were 28 times as thick and you kept the same separation, it wouldn't look that different.
It would be slightly more rounded, I think.
Slightly more something, but not that different.
As I said, the main technical difficulty that we were testing on this was the sensitivity to roughness. And
right, and what I'm pushing you maybe unfairly before the case is the so-called Derriaghan approximation or proximity force thing, where things are looking opposite to each other, and that's systematically being lost, of course,
So
I guess, am I allowed to think of the green line as still that approximation?
If you put these very close together, then that would give really the triangular green line. So
would also be if I use that approximation at any separation. You're always looking.
If you've got thin sheets as well. So if you have to have very thin sheets and.
Have you looked at this?
Perpendicular? No.
Are these in a box?
These are in a box. So the box size is 63, mm-hmm. and the diameter is 42.
All directions.
And periodic boundary conditions?
Periodic boundary conditions. So this is about the limit of what we can do. We can do a little bit bigger than this in three dimensions with the full wave equation. We were also interested in seeing how far we could push it.
Were one to do an inverse 6-power summation, or how kind of thing, how different would it look? It would not be that.
It wouldn't be that different.
Proximity force or the Derriaghan approximation. It would be rounded again, would it not?
Yeah.
And I'm just curious, does the shape of that thing depend on the nature of the approximation? Or just the magnitudes of the
unit. We've not done a detailed comparison between.
That might be a nice, easy thing to do to compute.
So that's sort of the maximum size and the maximum detail that you can build in if you're doing this in three dimensions. This is clearly too coarse to be able to study really very delicate effects like crossovers between retarded and non-retarded. I think you can get numbers which are at the few percent level for the geometries that you choose and the spectrum that you choose, but you can't study the fine details of the interaction. So to counter that, we decided to be real theorists and we went down a dimension. And so I'm now going to show you a few plots that come from two dimensions. But I think there's some interest maybe for interacting with the theorists who can calculate things, because you can do much, much more detailed measurements. So the first thing we wanted to do was really test our frequency integration. And so we chose a system now with dimensions 2,000 squared in two dimensions. Now what we're interested in is having a frequency integration that works one time for all ways, because you don't want to tune exactly how you do your integration depending on how far apart your particles are. Because if you were to have some complicated object, then you can't tune everything simultaneously. So our test here was to take just two particles and to try to measure the van der Waals interaction between two particles in two dimensions. Now, in two dimensions, the van der Waals interaction, the non-retarded, is 1 over r to the fourth. And the retarded version is one dimension lower, one over r to the 5. So what we've done...
The things that have a large area compared to the separation...
No, this is really two-dimensional electrodynamics now.
Okay, so the things are literally two. I don't get you. You're within...
Which kind of two-dimensional is that? Two guys moving like this, two guys like this. Where are the fields allowed to go?
No, so, you've got a two-dimensional network,
yeah.
And you write down Maxwell's equations in two dimensions.
And you have particles.
You have two particles on sites of the. So you have a two-dimensional lattice, and you just take two particles on your lattice.
Two dipoles.
So this is the really trivial case, just as, again, I'm presenting it as a test case to show that we master the numerics of calculating the interaction in two dimensions.
Is your electromagnetic field in two dimensions? That is,
so the electric field is 2n component, and the magnetic field has 1n component. So you imagine the number of electric and magnetic d's of freedom are not the same.
So basically lines in 3D plus 1 dimension.
So let me show you the results. If I plot the interaction energy between two dipoles times r to the 5, which is the power adequate for the retarded interaction, then I find this flat curve. So to within the fact that you've got a completely constant. So this is scaling out the major part of the interaction. So you're really magnifying any defects. I could have plotted stuff just as U, and then you would get a whole string of curves which go down very steeply, and you don't see any detail in the curves. Here I plot the interaction energy times what you expect, r to the 5. And for a system which is physically retarded, then I get a very good constant. The van der Waals interaction then corresponds to 1 over r to the 4th, and that's parallel to this curve here. And I see that I tuned the frequency parameter delta, I can go smoothly from systems which are dominated by van der Waals interaction 1 over r to the 4th over a large scale to 1 over r to the 5th for a large scale, and I have systems where I can study simultaneously, for instance, the crossover from the van der Waals to retarded.
Different color data correspond to different choices.
So this is the different colors are different values of delta in a one-pole approximation for the spectral weight. So that's all done with one set of numerical integration weights for the frequency part, and it shows that the code really gives what you expect for dipoles.
And the curves were not scaled to be the same value at large r? There was no other...
At large r? No. Let me think.
They all go to 1.
They all go to this curve, which is the retarded curve. So some they all have the same epsilon at zero frequency. And so when the separations are large enough, they all go to the same retarded interaction.
So it's universal.
Which is the large range part. There's a little bit of curvature here, and this is because you're starting to see the size of the box due to the periodic boundary conditions. So then you can start doing more complicated systems. And this was inspired a little bit by an old article measuring the interaction between a particle and a rough surface. So we generate some rough surface like this and measure the interaction energy between a particle and this surface. In the retarded regime, the interface, the energy should go as 1 over r cubed, but due to the roughness, as we heard yesterday as well, you get all sorts of corrections. And so again, I present the same plot, or similar plot. We look at the free energy times r cubed. This curve here is the interaction between a flat surface and the particles, and I see that the interaction between the, or the averaged interaction between the rough surfaces and the particle deviates substantially and is much higher, especially at shorter distances. Now, if you look at the difference between these two curves, you get this green curve, and you can fit this interaction here as 1 over r to the fourth. As you can see that, so here we've done 1,000 realizations. So you can, this is done with a system size of 1,000. You average over 1,000 realizations, and you can get quite detailed statistics and extract, for instance, very good correction to scaling power laws from working in two dimensions. So it's clear one is never going to do the experiments in two dimensions, but for people who have analytics and want to test maybe analytic theories of, for instance, disorder and the amplitude of the correction due to disorder and roughness, I think this is a demonstration that using the two-dimensional case, you can extract really quite detailed information about what's going on in the system.
Could you do tests with this on a rough surface where you could bring the particle quite close to various of the points?
Certainly.
And I'm just thinking that those are the sort of cases where these ideas about SIRs, you know, the enhanced fields near points on metal surfaces or something might be conceivably relevant and give you stronger attraction. It's just a hunch. It's nothing I've tested or even had any real reason to suppose it's true. But it might be worth testing.
So just that whole neat idea that the nearest stuff over contributes or something.
Yeah, the very curved points on the surface might have lots of field lines somehow that somehow translates itself into
the
fluctuation
as well as
just the Coulomb physics.
That's certainly some of the logic that we're interested in, and why the reason why we tried to develop these tools, where I think you really can, you can't use this as a method for generating comparisons with experiments, but you can certainly use this to compare with theories and theories of the effects of disorder and the coupling between different degrees of freedom in disordered systems.
This is all in the retarded limit?
This is all in retarded.
Shouldn't there be some self-similarity, so if this is a rough surface, without things fail, but maybe boost certain.
So this roughness is just a realization of a random walk. So so it's a exponent 1/2. I played a little with Levy flights and things like that, but then they become harder to interpret because you get large jumps, and you can't analyze as simply the data. But certainly you can, you know, you can build your favorite model of a rough surface with some affine scaling. And look at the detail.
This is completely self-similar.
This is a pure random walk.
And it's in a retarded limit, so you're
with retarded limit.
Then
it's not self-similar. That it is just, if you want to term it in terminology of fractals, self-affine fractal with some exponent 0.5. This is a kind of random walk, not self-similar. Self-similar is very complex geometry.
But no,
you don't have anything. Just.
But this is essentially input. You can really build your favorite model of a random surface in 2D and measure these things in as much detail as you want.
So in here, are we seeing the surface looks blurrier and blurrier as the distance increases, so that
the way I understand this is that the way I understand this is that you're at some distance d from the surface, and then typically you're going to see also things which are d laterally away.
Right.
And if they're d laterally away, then on average those are going to be square root of d higher or lower. Okay, and so there's a fluctuation. And that's the actual of the fluctuation, and this is what you would expect by just using this argument, that it's a square root of d higher or lower.
I guess I'm asking an intuition question. Like, if I count that r and I go to 100,
yeah.
So where's your hand in terms of the roughness of that?
Sorry, say this, ask the question again. 100.
At flat surface.
This is 100. in the scales, and the scales are not plotted uniformly. The scale here is 1 to 1,000, 0 to 1,000, or 1 to 1,000. The scale here is 450 to 600, so I've blown up the scale here, and this is a scale of 100. So I've measured, essentially I've measured that far out in this system, but roughly as you see in this plot.
And when does it get looking essentially smooth? It's almost there, right?
What do you mean by smooth here?
Well, I'm so far
that you're into the
peaks and valleys.
That you're in the asymptote.
Yeah.
You see that
is that it already? That green.
Well, spot? This is the curve of the mean interaction.
Right.
Now the question: where would you say it goes off? About here, I'd say. Yeah?
Oh, I was misreading it completely. Then I see. Okay.
So this is what, 2, 3, 4. So beyond about 4, which is really quite close to the surface, you're already beginning to be into this asymptotic regime. At least with this law. Now there were key. I did this with Levy flights, and Levy flights, you see all sorts of weird stuff. So depending on what model of disorder you put in, you can get very much more exotic curves for these interactions. But then you don't understand.
I'm looking for some kind of forgiveness criterion when roughness can be has to be recognized when it has where it's sort of intractable and when it's.
So. I think it's fairly the interpretation is fairly simple, that you go up a little bit.
Yeah.
And then you see some window horizontally.
Right, exactly.
And that's true where however high up you go, because I've used a random walk without any cutoff, without any. And so as far up you go, is you're seeing wider and wider
that's
windows.
That's the intuition, and it works here.
Maybe I'm going to accelerate a little bit. Things we want to do. Coming from the soft kinetic matter side, the most interesting system that I know of course, water. And there are really crazy things that go on if you look at the dielectric properties of water. If you plot the dielectric constant of water as a function of wave vector, it starts at 80 or so for the wave vector small, and then there's this completely crazy behavior.
Hang on a second. When you say k, you're talking about the k of the light, so this is actually just a proxy.
It's more neutron scattering X-ray.
What I'm saying is you're not looking into an epsilon, which depends on the spatial wavelength in the matter. You're still assuming a matter responds locally.
I know, but this is the whole point.
K is a proxy for the frequency of the
No. I'm looking at that. Sorry, I flipped here. I'm still at omega equals zero.
So maybe
I ought to say that. The interesting thing is that if you have D and E, and you look in Fourier space.
Yes, sure.
So
it really is the K of the mean.
And you have a 1 over epsilon of K, which links them. This is really K at omega equals zero. Okay, and there is this completely crazy behavior that there's a whole band of wave vectors where the dielectric function is negative. You're used to having dielectric functions with dielectric constants which are positive. Water is one of the rare and exceptional systems where there is a band of wave vectors with negative dielectric behavior.
They have an argument that this doesn't really violate the stability.
This is an order argument, which there's a I should have checked the name of the authors. There's a Review of Modern Physics on superconductivity, which has this argument, which it doesn't violate stability criteria. Uh-huh. That's discussed in detail. I can give you the reference.
Yes, please.
So how do we do this? How do we get this sort of picture in our machinery, and can we go anywhere with it? So this is what we're working on at the moment. So this is getting into newer material. Again, we have our constraint that we have Gauss's law. And what you need to do now is generalize the energy that I wrote down earlier on. Earlier on, I had the energy, which was the electric field squared, which I write in terms of D and P. I have the normal dielectric term, which involves the electric susceptibility chi. What I should do now is write some sort of Landau expansion in terms of P. And so what's particularly interesting is that you have derivative terms in P, and this is a so you're now getting into non-local dielectric constants.
This is the sort of thing you'd put in a plasma model. It's what they call the plasma pressure term.
Okay.
Yeah, usually this is referred to as the Inkson model.
This is a good reference for me. And what's interesting is that systems like water actually have this kappa being negative. And so you actually have to stabilize it by adding higher order gradients in P.
Couldn't you do that, but just assuming that kappa, I mean, go to Fourier space and then kappa is k-dependent?
So why am I interested in doing this? Is because, again, I think I know how to put this on a computer. And so we can start now playing with the interplay that you're going to have strong modifications of these fluctuation potentials in the presence of these gradient terms. In particular, you get gigantic fluctuations, a gigantic susceptibility at a finite Q, which is sort of correspond to the fluctuations in the hydrogen bonding. And the question is what does this sort of fairly elaborate model of dielectric response give in terms of real interactions between, for instance, two dielectric surfaces? Are there substantial modifications to the naive classical interaction energy that come when you have this sort of energy? And I think that the numerical methods that we have already developed are capable of treating this form of energy, and that's why I write it in this maybe slightly unconventional form, is because it allows it to be absorbed by the machinery that we have.
I just have a little comment here. You can derive this kind of model exactly for ice.
Yep.
This is the Onsager-Dupuy model.
Okay.
It's exactly what you have there, except that all the constants there, of course, depend on the local geometry of the hydrogen bond network, the concentration of the Gehring defects, and so on.
Okay, but I should take some references from you because I don't know those. So to conclude, we started off by inventing a Monte Carlo algorithm to solve or to contern the problem of solving Poisson's equation. This is in some ways more powerful than conventional Poisson solvers because it allows us to do electrostatics in the presence of an arbitrary dielectric background. And then we discovered quite by chance that it adds in the classical fluctuations. I said that we had a Monte Carlo version of this. In fact, there are also molecular dynamics implementations based on this idea, and those are available, I think, in LAMMPS and in Espresso, which is the Mainz code. Then we moved on, and we discovered that these sparse matrix methods allow you to study rather complicated geometries, especially if you're willing to go down the dimension. And these are quite simple things to do technically because we mostly work in MATLAB, and these are about 200-line programs in MATLAB. So they're really something you can give to a graduate student. In a week or two, you can produce curves quite easily. We've not exploited at all 2+1 dimension geometries. It's entirely trivial to so for instance, you're interested in a cylinder coming down on a surface, you can Fourier transform in one direction, then use Shalesky in the two perpendicular dimensions. And so for those sort of geometries, we can do the same sort of tricks, again, with dimensions of 1,000 by 1,000 in terms of discretization. So we can, if you're interested in doing fine discretizations of for instance, cylinders coming down on surfaces, we can do 1,000 by 1,000, I think, relatively easily. And then sort of a question is, can we go back and reintroduce all these interactions in real codes? Because I showed you that our algorithm gave you the classical part. I showed you that the quantum part was just a product of similar partition functions evaluated with different dielectric constants. It would be entirely trivial to set up a system with multiple omega slices. The particle would be in the same position on the network in every omega slice, and then you would have different dynamics for the electrodynamic fields in each slice. And that would give you a slightly cumbersome method of having the full resummation of the quantum, at least the non-retarded code. It would be particularly easy to do. And the question is that interesting? Would it be, are there really cases where it would be interesting to have codes where you could do a Monte Carlo or a molecular dynamic simulation and have the full quantum interaction resummed exactly? Because I think that's not difficult. I think people who do quantum simulation would find that almost trivial. You speak to someone like Seppeli and so on, and they would say...
There's a problem. So you could do that by doing Coward-Statonovich on the R formulation for, let's say you have ions in the system.
Yeah.
But then you would end up with an action that contains an imaginary term.
And not if you work with E. That's the whole point.
If you have ions in addition to the field, and ions, of course, being charged are coupled to the field, that will give you a term in the action that is imaginary. And people around here, let's say Glenn Fredrickson, work on...
No, I know that.
Okay. They have the same problem with imaginary action. How to solve that when you numerically simulate...
For most of the sign problems, you see, when you do Hubbard-Stravonovich normally with Coulomb potentials, you get the grad phi squared upon 2, then actually what you get is the I rho phi. So when you do Hubbard-Stravonovich, normally you get the I in the, because you use Hubbard-Stravonovich to work in terms of phis. The whole point of everything I did, why did I introduce E, is because it's an equivalent to Hubbard-Stravonovich that is real.
You know, when you do Hubbard-Stravonovich for an ionic fluid, the phi that you have there is an auxiliary field. It can be anything.
Yeah.
Later, when you do the saddle point, you interpret it as local electrostatic.
Yeah.
But you need not. So the problem with imaginary action will remain there, irrespective of how you formulate your field part, the real field part of the partition part, I think.
I've not written any code and I've not planned the code. These sort of things you have to plan. But I think the tricks that we have would enable you to...
The charges, right?
But not with the ensemble of ions, let's say, that you have in the Coulomb fluid. He has external charges, but those you have to also trace over the ionic charges.
I think they just live in the omega equals zero slice. The way you would
that
do it, you would just put them in the omega equals zero slice, and then
But that's not my point. My point is that if you would do the trace over the ionic degrees of freedom, you will, I think, necessarily get a term in the action that is imaginary, and that will create problems.
I think I know where you're coming from, but I'm not sure that we're quite speaking about the same thing. I think that we have to sit down with a piece of paper and talk about that.
Another comment, you know, you showed the Kornishev simulation, which of course is for an infinite system.
Yep.
And then epsilon of k and non-local, spatially non-local epsilon is the same thing.
Yeah.
You can Fourier transform.
Yeah.
Now, if you have a boundary, which is really what you're interested in, it's the boundaries. There. I mean, I'm not sure.
Oh, no, no, agreed. But that's...
Yes, it depends on both arguments separately.
Sure. So what's going to be interesting... So what's going to be interesting here? This plus a higher derivative term gives you something qualitatively like Kornishev. Okay? Then what you have to do is essentially say these derivative terms have a coefficient which is a function of the space. So this, I think, is the natural... This is a very natural Landau-type expansion...
True.
For the free in real space, and since it's in real space, then you can put the coefficients as a function of spatial position.
Okay, but if you want to do it that way, to come up with the free energy in terms of the derivatives, there are other terms apart from divergence of B squared.
Sure.
And
he
discusses, you know, the how to put together the theory of non-local dielectric response for bulk media with the same media in the presence of an interface. And it's got other terms.
I know that there have been very complicated, for instance, Cornishup as well, I think, wrote down a very complicated mean field type picture with multiple polarization fields and couplings to densities and so on. And it's good in that it fits the data from the computer. I think it's too complicated for what we're interested in, which is exploring just qualitatively what you've got this finite Q, almost it's quasi-critical point. It's almost critical at finite Q due to the fluctuations in the hydrogen bonding network. What does that do? That must give some long-range, quasi-critical, oscillatory interaction between
the most important consequence
between plates.
Is that as you go to small separations, the epsilon of Q will cancel the divergence. It will not be, you know, Lipschitz, of course, the way it's formulated, because it's for sharp dependence of the epsilon at the boundary. It's like a box profile. It will always give you a 1 over d squared profile, which is non-realistic. Absolutely. And if you take epsilon of k in the medium between the two surfaces, that will smooth out the divergence. It will go to a constant value. I know that.
Okay.
Or if either of them, if the two media are normal, too.
Also, yeah,
that also.
But that's, in many respects, it's easier because you don't have to deal with the problem of, you know, response that depends on two coordinates, as you have to when you have the media in between the two outer media.